Hi everyone, Barney here. Welcome to another episode of Loco Ludus, another interview, this time with Amanda P, and we're talking about her pilgrimage of the Sun Guard zine. Very interesting, very exciting discussion. This interview's been in the can for quite a long time, but as seems to be the way, things have just prevented me from putting it out. On that topic of the frequency of episodes, Amanda has agreed to come on the show a bit more regularly. At the moment, we're thinking that we'll record something once a month. So I hope that this is a way to get back on having slightly more regular episodes. So Amanda and I will have a discussion about whatever the hell we like, whatever the hell people perhaps suggest they would like us to talk about, assuming we've got something we feel we could say about it. Plus, I've got a number of people that I'm really looking forward to interviewing in the near future as well. So we could be looking at a monthly discussion show with Amanda and at least one interview. And I still want to talk about my other projects. But maybe there's room in that in those episodes with Amanda. Let's see. I will put out an episode that returns to Neo-Triassic Shoreline Regression Syndrome very soon, which is still slow funding. You can go and support it now. That's been going really nicely with the two parallel playtest groups. Really enjoying that. More to say about that, which I will do in that next episode. So in the meantime, here is a really interesting discussion with Amanda about Pilgrimage of the Sun Guard. Enjoy. Hi, Amanda.
Hello, you go by Barney, right?
I do go by Barney. That's absolutely right. It's really nice to have you on the show and to be talking about your spectacularly titled zine, Pilgrimage of the Sun Guard. First up, where does that title come from, Amanda?
When I was starting to work on this game, what I tend to do when I write stuff is I do a lot of reading first and then I start writing. And so for this, the title came from just me kind of, I had been working on a mega dungeon and the Sun Guard and it were a faction in that mega dungeon. And I ended up not being excited about that project at all, but being very into this, reading a bunch of Arthurian books. And then it kind of evolved into a Arthurian book. So much of them is deeply tied into Christianity. And I wasn't necessarily interested in exploring religion through a game, but I wanted to explore the idea of that, of just like Arthurian codes and corruption and tragedy and like the melancholy, but exciting nature of being on a trip on your own. And so that kind of all kind of, and I read a lot about religious pilgrimages. I've been listening to this podcast about the Crusades, and I found it really interesting. A lot of the early Crusades and the first Crusades, so much of it has become like this like weird thing, I think, because people play Assassin's Creed of thinking of like the Knights Templar being these like very intense orders. And I mean, they were, but this is all kind of, that's kind of where the title came from, is it's like a big soup of Arthurian stuff, learning about the Crusades, me just kind of vibing with words.
Title-wise, it's a lovely title. And I mean, in design-wise, what you just said, I think is really interesting, that you were working on something else and something from that developed into this idea of the Sun Guard. I mean, that's one of the things that I always like to talk to people about, is the kind of design process they've gone through. And even to ask about things that maybe didn't find their way into the final version or steps that you took. So, I mean, it's really interesting to hear that you had this mega dungeon and now the Sun Guard has found its way into this. I've not studied it as closely as I could have, but I read that you start as the last kind of able member of the Sun Guard to take up this calling. And that, of course, is a very powerful kind of image because you've got this lone, you are the lone figure, but that you come from a really important heritage, I suppose. You carry the weight of that role. And that's how you start, right?
Yeah, it's something I thought a lot about, and I think it's because I was raised Catholic, and so I think a lot of Catholicism is a very weird old religion in the way for some because there's just so much of it that's tied into like absorbing lots of the spirit like early like earth-based spiritualities of like various cultures and things like that. It kind of became a strange amalgamation of those things, and I'm very always especially I'm not religious now, but I'm very interested in the idea of like saints. And so with all of that, it kind of I'm very interested in how religions are not as like religion's different now, but how after something very big and great falls, there's still all these people that are still tied to like these kinds of beliefs and practices that are maybe not the dominant like cultural like milieu anymore. But there's people who still feel like a belonging to that. And it might, some of it might just be that I'm American. And so America, like the experience of being a person who is American, who is not like from like a particularly dominant culture, means that sometimes you have cultural experiences and practices that are not the homogenous experience of like what the world experiences as this is what an American is. Does that make sense? Like I'm half Puerto Rican and I'm Irish, so it's like I'm a mixed kid. And so that I have all those that stuff. But if you like watch TV and things like that, America's cultural exports, they're very, it presents like one way of like what that is.
Sure. And I just when you're talking there, I was just thinking that, of course, these symbols endure, symbols stick around. So if there are people that still carry some elements of something that might have faded, we also have all of these signifiers of principles or values and so on and so on. Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, spirituality is a big, is a big thing anyway, isn't it? Played journaling games or solo games. I've got a wonderful teenage son who will play games with me most of the time. So I'm really interested to hear from you about something about designing solo games or what you feel that offers different to other things.
For me, I hadn't played any solo games either until I played Thousand Year Old Vampire, which is a game by Tim Hutchings. And I don't know, I feel like a kinship with Tim Hutchings because we both are people who came who were like art world people first and then came into games later. He's obviously like very accomplished and his game is beautiful. But when with that, and also I have, I guess, a gaming mentor, you could say, and friend. Her name is Tam. She publishes under Hedionic Inc. And I can send you the link. But she has written like
Please, yeah.
that's like her whole thing is all she's done is write solo games. And I when I was first kind of coming into the like the OSR and then like the NSR indie tabletop RPG space over the COVID pandemic, I just kind of read a lot of games. And so that with that, designing a solo game is what you asked about. I would say it depends on what kind of experience you're trying to create. Initially, this game started after it was no longer a mega dungeon. It became, it kind of, it wasn't originally prompt based, but it was kind of a hack of two games, Cairn by Yochai Gall and Tam's game Scherzo, which is like a solo swashbuckly kind of game. But as I was doing it, something I find really inspiring from Thousand Year Old Vampire is the idea of the resource management around the idea of memories. But this game, that wasn't really the direction I wanted to go in. So I wanted it to be about resolving conflicts using the resources of like a knightly adventurer. And so that's kind of where like the very loose idea of stats came in this game, which manifests in a resource pool. Because for me, this game is less about, it's about creating a curated experience that has like dynamic things that can happen. With solo games, so much of it is like your experience will be whatever you bring to it. Like in this game, there's a lot of small adventures and things that can happen through prompts. Like in the play example in the game, you need to get across this river and you have to kind of make things directed. It's like you have to cross the river. But what you get to make a choice about as the player is how you decide to do it and how you use your resources to do it. So it's like you could duel the knight who's standing on the bridge who's not going to let you cross. You could sneak across the river. And so it's like all those things, those actions you decide to do, inform the character you're creating. And so if you decided to make a character that's like an elderly scholar, which is what I playtested this game as, because I wanted to make sure the game, you didn't just have to be like a hulky bro to get through the game. That kind of all inform that.
Just to say a little bit about me, I also come from an arts background. It's a very satisfying pastime thinking about games as an art practice, I think, isn't it? And your zine is a very nicely laid out zine. Really leads you through very nicely. And you've packed in a lot of stuff, I think, haven't you? You know, it's very stripped down, but there's a lot there, which is super. Really of that minimalist mindset, which is fab. My suggestion is that you help me make a character, and we see how that goes, right? The stats that you talked about, would you like to just briefly tell us about them? They're a really nice set of stats.
Sure. So the central crux of this game is you're the last person who's in an order of like knights and scholars and things. Your order has become fallen down and not corrupted, but just kind of doesn't have the prestige it once had. It's kind of considered strange or mysterious by like the world that has gone on without you. And so central tension of the game is about you being this person that has this code that people don't necessarily get, traveling through the world and going on adventures because you've been essentially ordered to go on a quest because it's necessary. And so it's you're the only person who can do it, and so you have to go. So with that, the game is about learning from mistakes and not you can play this game and decide to just like sink into despair, but it's heavily encouraged within the description of how to play that you don't do that.
Okay.
But anyway, the resources are, it's kind of a pretty, it's might, like, so it's like your strength and your agility, your guile, so it's meant to be your cleverness, your social intelligence, your charisma, if you want to go there. Honor, which is your perceived trustworthiness, because in a early society, so much of it is when there is like, there can be differences of like custom and money and like ways of exchange and cultural differences. Your perceived trustworthiness would be worth a lot. Or your this could also be called reputation. And time. So time
now, just for the listeners, Amanda is doing little square quotes when you said early society and trust. I think we could still be considered an early society, couldn't we? Because of course honor and trustworthiness are things we kind of have to confront or the lack of, we have to confront every day, especially on the world stage, isn't it?
Thank you, Bernie. I'm definitely like a person that it expresses myself like with my hands, and so that doesn't always like come across well on a podcast.
No, it's great. I just thought it's a good thing for us to throw in there, you know. This, and I like the fact that this is this kind of outside aspect, you know. Might, your strength and agility, that's my strength and agility. Guile is my cleverness and social intelligence. But honor, there, it's my perceived trustworthiness. So it's an external, it's an externally grounded stat. That's really interesting. And the last one, Amanda.
Yes, and so time, everybody gets the same amount of time. You roll a pool that gives you, that you can divide between might, honor, and guile. So that kind of gives you, the player, some agency around the kind of character they want to make. But time, everybody gets six as time. And I write six as like weeks that the road is passable. And you, with time, you mark, the game is structured around set locations. And so you mark it per location, plus you have some extra to use as a resource.
I've played 10 candles, you know, where you're blowing out a candle, one of the 10 candles, as you head towards kind of impending doom, and that seems to have a little bit like that with the time falling away. Super. So are we ready to create a character then?
Yeah, one thing. The whole point of the game is go through the locations and complete your quest, and while you're doing it, earn deeds of renown, because you want to essentially, if it were like pro wrestling terms, it's like you're building up your reputation of the cool things you have done that you can brag about later.
Okay.
Because so I was reading Beowulf the other day, and it's like so much of the early part of Beowulf is just Beowulf bragging about the various like swimming things he's done and all these other things he's accomplished.
Yeah.
And it feels, I felt like that was a fun way to earn things throughout the game. So anyway, let's make a character.
Okay. What do we start with?
First, we're going to start with, you're going to make a person who believes their code and their honor is their life. So you're going to choose a background. You could roll for a background or just choose one yourself.
Yeah, I've got real dice here. Oh, and I mean, it says here that you use 2d6, 1d4, and 1d8. Not always your most common selection of dice. So I'm intrigued to know why you came to that one. Is there any reason for that?
It's kind of, it is where I ended up with like the tables I was writing, to be honest.
Not you. Yeah. Why not? They're in the dice tray. Use them. Okay. Yeah. So are these the sparks for character ideas that we're going to roll on here then?
Yeah. First, if you don't want to choose your you can choose a background or roll a d4.
I see. So I'm going to choose between apprentice, romantic, cloistered, or veteran. Let's see what the d4 throws up for me. It's a two. I'm going to say that's romantic, going left to right. Okay, so I'm a romantic. Okay.
So with the romantic, the idea of it, your code is you experience life's bank through poetic acts of valor. You can choose two traits. Which two traits do you choose?
Okay, the choices are passionate, worldly, artistic, and brave. I am going to be worldly and artistic.
Wonderful. And your cherished item is a loved one's token. Each background has a cherished item as a way to just like give the character more oomph and build them, give them a connection to the world or to a person.
Okay, I've got a little, I've got a little kind of straw sculpture that someone's kind of folded and woven. That's what I've got with me.
Wonderful. Roll 2d6.
Okay. 2d6. I've rolled a 1 and a 6.
All right, so that means you have a resource pool of 7. So what you would do then is divide that 7 up between might, guile, and honor.
Okay. Mike Guile honor 7 between them. Guile honor. So I'm going to say 3 for honor. I'm going to say 2 for guile and 1 for might.
Three,
Is that
two,
that's
one.
six?
That's six. You need
That's
one more.
six. Okay. Then I'll be 2 in might. I'll be 2, 2, 3.
Great. And then just write down time six.
And times 6, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So after that, you're going to roll on these spark tables for character ideas.
Okay.
So six, roll a six for why did your character join the Sun Guard?
For educational pursuits, magic, technological, or religious.
Choose which.
Yeah, can I take magic as poetic? Yeah, okay, so I take poetic magic.
What do they look like? Roll a d8.
Okay, that's a D8. Yeah, okay. Ah. I look soft and lined with care.
I love this soft poet, romantic poet with a straw thing. This is good. What is their greatest gift? So roll a six.
Okay, this is a 6. It's a 6. So my greatest gift is being charismatic and a leader of people.
And then what do they wish for under the stars?
Okay, what do I wish for under the stars? That's my wife popping in to see who I'm talking to. This is a 6. What do I wish for under the stars? It's a 1. Oh, to remember. Oh, yeah, if only I could. If only I could remember, then
So,
things would be different.
yes. And so then you get to choose your name and your descriptor. I made a lot of names, probably too many names, but I love naming characters. So
Yeah.
roll a
Okay.
d6 three times.
Roll a 3, 3 lots of. Okay. So
Jesus,
there's
roll
a
again.
first name, a middle name, and a surname, or
Or
something.
you just choose a name. Yeah, because it's like I wanted to include names from different cultures so they weren't just like English, Irish knight
Yeah.
names.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. I've got going chronological here.
Got it.
1, 3, 5. So
One,
I'm
three, five.
Aisling. I'm
One,
Aisling.
so one, so you're gonna be in the first row. Three, so
Oh,
you're
I'm
in the
sick. Okay,
second row.
yeah.
Okay, so Nandor.
Wait, okay. Okay, now this I'm missing this trick that you've
So
got here.
it's all good. I've done it a million times.
Yeah.
So one means the, yeah, so one.
Next to the 1, there's a 1, 2, 3 down the side. No, it's not that, is it? I'm in row 1.
Column two,
Column
and then
two.
five. So you're Rima. But we can also go with Nandor because I had it. Yeah.
Oh,
So you're Rima
okay.
the poet.
Okay, Rima. Okay, good, 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 good.
And then descriptor. Same thing.
Okay. Still 3, or is this 2? This is 3.
This is
Okay.
three still.
Okay. 5, 4, 1.
Okay, so five, so second row, four, so second column, one, so bold. So Rima the
Bold.
bold.
Rima the Bold. Okay.
So Rima the bold. Went as a romantic who's studying poetic magic, who is, where is it? Soft and lined with care, charismatic
Yes.
leader of the people who wants to remember.
And so now basically I'm good to go. Is that what that's Yeah, that's
Yeah.
it. I'm done. Fantastic. Fantastic. Wonderful. Wonderfully evocative. Yes, and I feel slightly I feel relatively well-rounded. Like I feel a slightly mixed bag of things, which, you know, there's some kind of internal things to connect up there. Very nice, very nice. And so if I were to play this game and write down my adventure, my pilgrimage, and I were to kind of give it to you, what do you think it would, what would it look like? What would you imagine my book would look like?
What your particular journey would look like this
Yeah,
character?
I'm just wondering what would be like good homework, if I can put it like that. If someone handed something in, like if the player could, if a player could hand in the game to the designer, what kind of book would get an A? Or like, is that a weird question? I don't know.
Not weird. I think the whole goal for me for this game is that I want people to, and the goal for the character creation is like, I want to create a, people to be able to create a character that they immediately feel very attached to and feel, and like, even if they're very different from them, it's like that they can find ways that this is a person worthy of love. And so you feel feelings when this person is then put into danger and put into a quest that maybe they don't want to go on. And so for homework, I guess it would be about, I feel like I'm more interested in what that person ended up doing. Like, what did their quest look like? Because, like, a poet who's going on a journey who is interested in poetic magic will resolve prompts and like adventures in a very different way from, say, I have another a friend, Andrew White, who did a play of this. He was one of my play testers, and he created a character named Ghastly Comeuppance. And she was a scholar who carried around a giant book, and she was very unhappy to be going on the quest. And so it created a very like comedic experience. But I feel like a person who's like a poet going on a journey would probably write poetry. I want whoever plays the game. You know what I'm saying?
So I could kind of try and embody my character in the way that I write up my adventure, I suppose. Yeah, I played a couple of games of Wander Home recently, and I chose a poet in that, and that was quite good fun. I think the poets are interesting figures. That kind of economy of language is always good fun.
True.
Interesting. And so you've got a number of kind of episodes, right, that you move through. So you start by there's the departure, you cross a desert, there are shadowy pines, a river valley, ascending the frost cliffs sounds very dramatic, and the endless stairs, the declaration of deeds. And is that's the declaration of deeds, that's the final one. How was it in What was the experience like of coming up with that sequence of the adventure? Did you have others? Did you change the sequence round? Did things get Was it always the Frost Cliffs, or
I think it might have always been the Frost Cliffs. I'll have to look through. I was looking at a really early version, and it was a little different from this because it was still like when there was like real stats and there was like combat. But yeah, the thing I wanted to, yeah, the locations or whatever, like moments, whatever you would want to call them, were always these. The departure changed a lot because it's like I wanted to have it start with a prophecy. But I decided to make it around a little vaguer, but more specific in the sense that I wanted it to be about the adventure being under two motifs that you could then use as a resource, because it's almost like that thing that was prophesized is happening in your adventure or you're using it. And so with the locations, yeah, this flow kind of always existed because it's like it kind of came from me, just like my life of reading adventure stories. Like ascending the Frost Cliffs is probably my way of thinking through when Lord of the Rings, when they're going up the mountain and then they can't go up the mountain because the mountain is a magic mountain Caradhras. I never know how to say it, but and it's just like literally attacking them with dark magic so that they have to go into Moria instead. So because, and so I wanted it to be that the locations were like emblematic of the challenges that happen in most like adventure, like old adventure type stories, so that people could bring something of like their own cultural experience of like being a person who plays games or has read books to it.
Super. Now, there's the codes and corruption bit. Now, I particularly like this because in one of the game systems that I've got, there's a balance economy which you can use to get advantage, to spend to get advantage or cancel disadvantage. But when that hits zero, something kind of bad happens. And that's when you roll on a table to see what happens, and you've got the same thing going on here. So you say when you run out of resources, now is that running out of all of them or just any one of them? All of them. Okay, so when you're completely out of resources, then you roll on a roll of D6 and you get some prompts. And does that mean that you come back from that, or is that the end and you're kind of ending on this moment?
With the game, you have two choices. It's like you can choose when you run out of all your resources to end the game, but it's heavily encouraged that you don't. And it's built into the game when you look at the it's written into the, what is it called, the cycle of play, that it's kind of expected that someone will. And originally this didn't exist. Originally there was no, this part didn't happen, but then my first playtester rolled a 2 on her resource pool. So she had no resources and she failed almost immediately. And so then we needed to add something to the game because I didn't want, I was like, I don't want to make a, it's like the game's kind of melancholy because I'm kind of a melancholy person, but like, I didn't want it to be like that melancholy. And so the idea of this is that there's, with like, in Arthurian legends, there's a lot of stuff around people, like Lancelot breaks his code at times, I don't think Galahad does, but most of them have issues, have moments where they fail or are not their best self. And that's kind of the basis around this. And so I had to be really thoughtful when I was writing these because I didn't want it to be, I wanted it to be about like a character failing of some kind without it being too heavy. Mm-hmm. Someone can decide to go there and make it really heavy, but I didn't want it to be in the text itself.
I think this is such an important thing, and I really strive for that in my stuff as well, where you catch yourself thinking I'm actually closing down possibilities by introducing this element or this mechanic, and then trying to think of a way to still make it kind of sting or have an impact, but that it doesn't, it's not closing it down, it's just moving it somewhere else. So you've got this very neat solution that either you end the game or you break your code. So that would be me, breaking my code, which is, was that being worldly and artistic? No, that's okay. I think I skipped over this. We missed this bit, did we? My code. It's good that we've talked about this, isn't it? Is to experience life's banquet through poetic acts of valor. So to regain my pool, I would have to go against that, right?
Yeah.
So I would either have to, I would either have to turn my back on poetry or do something unvalorous or both.
Yeah.
That's heavy. That's quite heavy.
It is heavy, but that's why it says right there, this game is about hope and learning. Keep that in mind. Feel free to rewind and rework the fiction to suit you.
But I guess in terms of the solo gaming, that's quite a powerful moment, isn't it? To hit rock bottom and to write out how I would break my own code. and then continue. I mean, you know, it's like it's the grit in the oyster kind of thing, isn't it? That makes the pearl, I suppose. Wow, brilliant. Yeah, I'm really impressed with how much you've got in those few pages, if you like. What is it, 32 pages?
Yeah.
It's good, and it's super nice to read through and look through. Very nice. Would you like to say a little bit about your alternate rules or the alternate spark tables that you've got as well? Can you pick them straight off the bat, or are they best if you come back for a second time, or use them at a different point, or how do they work?
I think it's better to, if you're going to play the game for the first time, just like run it as is. But I think if you decide you want to play it, you want to go on a different journey, there's a couple different alternate rules that are around making prompts hard, like more complicated or harder. You can randomly roll the location order to change the order of the journey. And I made one that's, if you really want to turn into the bleak, you can start it with a dice pool of 1d6. Because the expectation is you will become corrupted more than once. If someone really wants to steer into that, like that is there if they want to.
That's good.
Yeah. And for the other,
because again, go on. Well, no, it's not, again, you're not, that's a design choice that isn't closing down the possibilities. It allows people to play how they want to play, which I think is super. Yeah, what were you going to say, Amanda?
Yeah, and for the other alternate spark tables, essentially it's like if people want to like write more of their own prompts, it's the kind of things and verbs and nouns and things that are in prompts if they want to keep going or write their own things. Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. they're just good sparks for if you're like trying to start writing an adventure or keying a dungeon. I just see them as just like I've been using them for another project I'm working on because I'm actually really happy with this game, and I've been using it as a tool to write other stuff now.
So not a mega dungeon. It was a mega dungeon. Now it's then it became a pilgrimage, and now there's some bits going on to somewhere else.
Super. That's kind of how I work, I think. I don't know. This is all very new. I've only been writing games since October.
Wow. Yeah.
So this is, and this game I wrote in a month. I wrote it from the day after Christmas until January 25th. And then I was like, I guess I'm doing Zine Month because it's done.
That's super. It's really interesting to talk to different designers about long-term projects and then short, you know, much quicker turnarounds on projects. I spoke to Isaac Williams, the designer of Mouse Ritter, and he was talking about how quickly he had put it together and play tested it, and then it was out. And I, you know, quite often we hear, don't we, that things have been worked on for a long time. But I think maybe from that artistic perspective, I think just because something is done speedily, it doesn't mean that it's rushed or something like that, I think. I'd love to ask you about what you're working on in the future, but first, do you have plans to make a print copy? Because I think someone was saying, oh, is it going to appear, will Amanda put out a print copy?
I am doing a print copy. I just wasn't sure how well it was going to be received, so I didn't say anything. But yeah, I'm working with LFOSR. I just got the test. I'm getting the test print in the mail any day now. I just sent him the final file yesterday, and it looks really pretty. I'm really proud of it. Cool. But it's going to be coming out. I'm not sure exactly yet. He's sending me the proof. I'm going to look at it to see, because it's like, if folks have seen the game, it's like very like orange and like ochre and then like white and black. And so I just want to make sure the colors look right, but he does such beautiful work. I just backed his like recent Kickstarter because his work is just so cool. I don't know. Yeah. But I don't plan on doing all my projects in print, but this one just kind of happened and it felt like it had legs and like, and people liked it. So.
Super. Yeah. Well, hopefully some copies will make their way over to Europe. Somehow. Super. That's super. So would you mind to tell us a little bit about these other things that you're working on?
Right now, I'm in the very early stages of writing. Right now, I think it's a depth crawl, like Gardens of Yin or Stygian Library, which are both projects by Emmy Allen, who does not get enough accolades for how amazing her work is. And every time I talk about it, I'm just like, ah, it's so good. But yeah, so I am working on a depth crawl. And I'm not, it's really early, so I'm just like writing a lot of tables and things. I'm basically also just trying to figure out, it's like, what are the tools that I will use for when I write dungeons moving forward for now? And like, what is useful for me to do procedural generation work? And so I'm just trying to curate tables of like ideas and like flavor of like rooms and like absurd things that can happen so that I can start randomly generating stuff to write things, because I find that I don't necessarily like randomly generating at the table when I GM, but I really love using it as a writing tool because I find it sparks a lot for me creatively. And other than that, I'm drawing a lot. I'm doing a lot of maps, which is kind of how I got into this whole thing, is like I do a lot of, I come from a theatrical design background originally. I don't do that anymore, but, and so I've done hand drafting. And so I'm kind of like getting back into that, getting back into watercolor painting. And I just kind of want to make more maps and things that are colorful, because I find that as much as I love like that, like gritty black and white with like skulls stuff, it's not always what makes my heart sing. Like I really love Nate Tremé's work because it's so just like colorful and welcoming. It's not that his dungeons are any less dangerous or as like places, but his games are just very, they have an element of charm that I find really like warm and inviting and approachable. And so I want my work to be approachable.
And I definitely think we've got a lot, there's a lot more work to be done beyond or outside of the kind of standard imagery, for sure. And, we're seeing all sorts of interesting alternative stuff coming up, but I think there's still loads more we can do that, like you say, is still an adventure, but isn't necessarily skulls.
I love skulls though. They're very fun. Yeah, like I've drawn some skulls. Yeah. They're great. I just want to I don't know. I know that I can't do that kind of thing as well as some people can.
Sure.
Like I'm not like super gritty as a person, but I want to just lean into like where my strengths are.
Sure. Super, super. Well, I think that's nearly all my questions for you today. But I do like to finish off my interviews by asking my interviewees to make some offerings to the Ludic Behemoth. Happy offerings, good offerings. And there are two offerings. And the first one is a game mechanism or component that you think is worth offering, and an underrated character archetype or skill.
Okay.
So game mechanism or component, and God, I keep forgetting this, an under acknowledged character archetype or skill.
I'm going to do character archetype first, because I think my strength is more characters first rather than locations. I'm developing locations by thinking about them as being like people. as like mm-hmm. things that have a history, but I think mm-hmm. I would offer, I love thing game like the character archetype of the person who is like unwilling or uninterested in being on a quest, but mm-hmm. is still isn't being like negative about it, is still engaging, but it's just like who's deeply uncomfortable with the the trials and tribulations of being on an adventure. Like the unwilling adventurer is very funny to me. Because, you know, I tend to, I'm in a West Marches game right now where I have a character that's like a halfling ex-cult leader guy who's like a scam artist. And he just is like deeply, he just like wants to be at his house, but because of financial reasons, he has to be on quests. It's why I like Electric Bastion Land.
Yeah, yeah.
The Failed Careers, yeah. That actually might be my game mechanic is like building for game mechanics. I don't know if this would count, but it's like building backgrounds of the kind of characters you want in your game into the game, I think is very valuable. It sparks creativity for people who need some like direction. I think it makes games more accessible for people because they don't have to feel like, oh, I have to invent this amazing character from scratch. And that, because that can be really, like the blank page can be scary for people. And I think the blank character sheet mm-hmm. can be off-putting as well. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people mm-hmm. don't get as engaged in our hobby because it can be hard to do that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. even if you look at Nature Maze Tunnel Goons, like you roll on like a couple tables and you got your little guy who's going on an adventure. And something Nate talks a lot about is like incorporating the idea of a character's past failure. And Chris McDowell does this too. And I think it's just building something like everybody can understand someone who has made a mistake. Because
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. nobody has not made a mistake. And so if you build mm-hmm. that into the character generation, I think it makes such a difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of rambly, yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
No, that's super. It's super. Yeah. And yeah, as soon as I heard Chris talking about Electric Bastion Land, I was totally, totally with it. Yeah. That idea that you have the leftover, the vestiges of this failed career, you know, you're still, I can't remember how he kind of puts it in the book, but you're still defined by it, but you've just sucked at it so badly. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. But that, you know, I was thinking about that the other day, you know, that is a game and a setting that really encourages players to create rather than to wait for the GM to inform them what the world is like. And I think that's, you know, that's been a real inspiration to me for sure. Yeah, super. Wonderful, Amanda. Thank you ever so much. Thanks for coming and talking.
Of course. Thank you, Barney, for having me.
I'd be very pleased if you come back and talk again when you've got your depth crawl ready to go.